We're doing Pirkei Avot. We're up to the fourth chapter, the fourth Mishnah. Rabbi Levitas is Yavne Omer. Rabbi Levitas, the important man of Yavne, he says the following. Me'od me'od hevei shfal ruach. A person should be extremely humble. This is the one trait where our sages said, go to the extreme. There are two reasons. One is because pride is such a disgraceful trait. And the second reason is because most people don't succeed in this trait. And you have to work harder at it. And he reminds us, Shetikvat enosh rima, because ultimately where is the human being going? He is going to be vermin. So if a person only thinks about that, that should calm him down. The Medrash says, why did God make us go to the bathroom? Seems a little animalistic. God didn't make us walk on all fours. We don't see the ground all the time. We walk with our head high. So how come in this we had to be like animals? And how come God made it that it's not so pleasant? It's not even pleasant to talk about it. So the Medrash says, it's a reminder to us. It's supposed to make us be a little bit more humble. We can wear suits and ties and be all fancy schmancy outside. But every one of us knows there's that moment in life where I can't wear my suit and tie. You can't be all fancy schmancy. There's a time when suddenly I'm a basic human being and I have basic human needs. The Medrash says we get so... What? Where's the Medrash? I think it's Tana de Belio, if I'm not mistaken. The Medrash says... The human being is so hoody. In spite of this, imagine what he'd be like if when he went out to the bathroom, perfume would come out. That's what the Medrash says. Hashem gave him a reminder that it's not so pleasant, and even so, he disregards the reminder. Imagine if it were the other way around. Now, this is at the root of many people's failings. One of the challenges of pride is that it's self-defeating. You try to tell a proud person that he's proud, and he's going to yell at you, who are you calling proud? It's a trait that is hard for a person to overcome and hard for a person to see in himself. There was once a couple that wanted that we should think together how they could advance their relationship or get out of a certain situation they were in. So I wrote them an email and I said, look, we can only talk about this if you're really, really willing to work on it. And they both wrote back, we're really, really willing to work on it. And I said, yeah, but maybe you should go to someone else who will, when he tells you you have to work on A or B or C, you'll respect it. If you pay 700 shekel for 45 minutes, you tend to feel like every word is a pearl. If you get the person's time for free or close to it, then you feel like, okay, so he said, I'd rather you go somewhere where you pay 750 shekel for 45 minutes. And then you'll really listen when he says you should work on A or B or C. So they said, no, we really want to and we'll take it seriously and blah, blah, blah. So I said, fine. So one of the two peers, when they described their situation, one side said, I know I'm wrong in A, I know I'm wrong in B, I know I'm wrong in C, I know I have to work on it, and fine. So we started talking about it. The other side said, side A is wrong in A, and side A is wrong in B, and side A is wrong in C. So I listened, I didn't say a word. Okay, week two, repeat of the same scene. One side comes in and declares they're wrong in a whole slew of things, and they're working on it, this much improvement, this much not improvement. Side B comes in and says, well, they're wrong in, they give the whole list. Now, I'm starting to see a pattern here, right? So after 2 weeks of one side working on something, I dared to make a suggestion that the other side, maybe, I didn't even say what they should work on. I was so scared, I just wrote the following email. I said, could you please reread your email in the description of what the other side is doing wrong? And tell me what you would answer if you were in my shoes. I just want a picture of where you want us to go. Just a picture. That's it, now I'm dead. I don't exist. Now they don't want to hear a word from me. Or at least one side doesn't want to hear a word from me. Why? Because if one side in a marriage, as much as they say, I'm willing to work on it, but all I'm willing to work on is I see what's wrong with the other side, so then even if It's just an insinuation. What did I ask? I didn't say they did anything wrong. I was very careful. I understood the picture a little bit. So all I asked was, what would you advise, if you were in my shoes, what would you advise? Could you reread? Because, you know, the other side has been working for 2 weeks. So now, what would you advise for your side to work on? No response. And I didn't know, but, you know, I couldn't figure out, like, what would I say that's the most minimal amount that you could start with? That's this challenge. When you're dealing with someone who the person doesn't see it on themselves, and all of us have this blind spot on some level. We can't look at our spouse and say he's haughty, she's haughty. The other side is something we all have to work on. It's true. We all have a certain level of haughtiness, but at the same time, we have to realize that it's very hard for anyone to talk to us, and it's very hard for ourselves to get out of where we're at unless we overcome this. There is no way out until a person is willing to hear it. And humility plays itself out in many situations. I once tried to talk to a husband who was in a situation where a divorce was imminent. They had a lot of kids, and he had a lot to lose. And I said to him, let me just ask you one question. Have you ever lost an argument with your wife? So he said, no, because I'm always right. So I said, look, every time we tried to discuss where you were wrong, you started pulling in new facts into the story and explained to me why I don't have the full picture. You're right, I can't argue with you. You have the full picture and I don't. But if you admit to me that you're always right in the argument, doesn't that say something to you? So he says, well, it says to me that I wouldn't argue if I didn't think I was right. And if she had a point, then why couldn't she make it? That should say something to us. Chazal tell us that when Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, they got divorced, by the way, to my sorrow and to many other people's sorrow, I mean, and to the children's sorrow. Everyone paid a price. Chazal tell us that the reason we paskin in halacha like Beis Hillel is because when they discussed the halacha, so they'd always proceed by presenting Beis Shammai's opinion. It takes a certain character to be able to take the opposing opinion and present it. And present it in a form that it belongs in a Mishnah. Very often, I'll tell people, you disagree, why don't you each take the other one's side and explain it? Explain the other side. Chavrusas, this works for also. You guys disagree? Explain what he's saying. What usually happens, everyone starts saying what the other one's saying, and as they're saying it, they're explaining why it's wrong. So you were saying this, which I don't understand how you could even think to say that because of this, 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 and that. And then you tried saying this, and that, you know, that doesn't make sense. Let's be for real. We're two intelligent adults. It begins with a certain mutual respect. I respect the other person. So what is the other person trying to say? Very often we're at our wits' end. We don't understand one another. One of the problems with that first couple we spoke about was that the same side that wasn't willing to hear they were doing anything wrong also viewed the other side as doing everything wrong. Meaning, why don't you look at the other side and say, I don't understand. Let's start with step one. But no. That same side that wasn't willing to hear they were doing something wrong was already saying, I do understand. The other side is self-centered. And now, I'm not saying that side was wrong in saying that. I don't know. What I do know is that you can't move forward so long as you're interpreting the other side for themselves. You guys with me? Yeah? So, the point of humility is a very, very key point to gaining understanding. And we all have this weakness. Now, one of the points that really egg us on is that we can all end up like that second husband. Because in conversation, very often, the different conversational styles lend themselves to a husband winning an argument. Arguments are usually built on logic, at least when men talk, and we try to build our case, so we're going to present our case, And at the end of the day, she'll say, yeah, what you said makes sense. So do you agree with me? No. I don't understand. You said it makes sense. Why don't you agree with me? It doesn't feel right. She's talking on a different level. She might be right. Just because she can't articulate in our terms why she disagrees doesn't mean she's wrong. So you'll tell me, so how do you decide? I think step one is respecting the other's opinion. There was a couple that wanted to move. So the husband went and saw apartment number one. He came back. He told the wife, it's exactly what we were looking for. Come see. She comes and sees the apartment. She says, no, it's no good. He says, what's wrong? She says, the counters are too low. The kids will be able to pull everything off the counters. So he says, fine. He continues looking, finds apartment number two. He says, it's perfect. It's exactly what we were looking for. She comes. She sees it. No, it's not good. What's wrong? The counters are high enough. The kitchen is big like you wanted. They're exactly the number of rooms we wanted. She says, yeah, but there are trees all around in the position. You have no lighting. It's not good for the kids. No good. Fine. Finds apartment number three. He calls her up. He says, look, you wanted second floor? Got a second floor. You wanted a big kitchen? It's got a big kitchen. You wanted high counters? It's got high counters. You wanted sunlight? There's sunlight. You wanted the, what else? Number of rooms, everything. It's what we wanted. She comes, looks. She looks. She looks. She looks. She says, no. He says, okay, you find the apartment. So she says, what do you mean? He says, well, you gave me the criteria. I looked according to your criteria. And what's wrong with this one? She says, I don't know. It doesn't feel right. Now, to a husband, that's the most frustrating thing in the world. So husbands, at this point, most husbands enter the mode of mocking. Feel right? So explain this to me. So how am I going to get you to feel right with an apartment? This is where husbands are at their wit's end. And this is where usually you hit the blow up. He's saying, you know, I ran around, I did the research, I looked, I went, I saw what, you gave me the criterion, I went by your criterion, I got everything you asked me for, now it doesn't feel right, so how do I get you to feel right? You understand? What he takes is, it's hard for him to respect what she's saying about the apartment, so now it becomes her. She's the problem. How do I change your feelings? How am I going to find an apartment that fits your feelings? Why? Because she's talking about the way she perceives it. And to a woman, how she feels is very much a part of it. And you know what? Very often she's right. Very often it's what we might call female intuition. And even if she's wrong, usually the wife spends much more time at home than the husband. So if it doesn't feel right, we should respect that. I know a couple that didn't. So they had this male-female argument. He said, well, it's got criteria A, right? She said, right. It's got criteria B, right? She said, right. He's going down her checklist and everything she says, right. So he says, it all adds up to, we take the apartment, right? She said, right. He went out and signed on the apartment. He came back and she said, you did what? He said, I signed on the apartment. You agreed with me. It has all the criteria which adds up to, we signed on the apartment. You said, yeah, I went and signed the apartment. Oh boy. All I can say is they had a very miserable year of marriage. Because everything that happened in the apartment, she'd say, that, you see, I told you. He says, what do you mean you told me? You said yes. She said, I didn't say yes. I said, it adds up to that. I didn't say yes. So now you guys are all wondering.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, they were just renting that apartment.
Yeah, renting.
What?
Yeah, they were renting.
Baruch Hashem.
Baruch Hashem is right. It's interesting that they moved out of that apartment. And I was once there for a Shabbos meal when they were discussing this whole story. And I always like listening to couples talking. You learn. Couples, you'll be surprised. I when I was your age, I was going to couples' houses and I'd ask them for tips. And I learned a tremendous amount asking people for tips. People are willing to help. Listen to the wives, too. Very often they'll give you really, really good tips as a future husband. I learned a lot from just when I was dating, when I was going out. I'd ask people, what advice can you give a person towards marriage? And you can learn a lot. I still ask people that. Today I ask older people. People who have made it 40, 50 years into marriage. So I asked them, if you had one piece of advice you'd give, I have an excuse. I say, you know, I give a marriage class. So what tips would you give me? So what tips do you think I should tell the guys? And it's always interesting. One couple once said, tell them to hold on to their sense of humor, because without it, marriage is bitter. You know, they're married 50, 60 years. But they said, no, you got to have a sense of humor. You got to take one another lightly. You got to be able to laugh things off. You got to be able to laugh together and hold on to that. Different couples have said different things over time. Sometimes I regret I asked. Sometimes it's very interesting what people have to say. Very interesting, yeah. So they had this conversation, and she says to him, you know, that apartment was really a good apartment in hindsight. I was scared he'd blow a gut. And he's like, he was in the middle of eating, and he's like almost choking on his food. What? And she says, yeah, I couldn't swallow it because I didn't come to terms with it. Now, if we think about it, very often we're all that way. Very often I get questions, people ask me different questions in halacha or in shkafa, and I usually won't answer. And if I answer, I'll add a stipulation, provided that your wife agrees. And people very often ask, why? Why is that so important? Because no one wants something shoved down their throat. Very often I'll tell a husband, I want to talk to you and your wife. Why? It's if you ask me, the first thing I'll ask a husband is, does your wife know we're talking? And does she approve of the fact we're talking? Because if she's happy that we're talking, then it's both of your question. If it's your question, and she wants to ask someone else, so find someone that you both agree on. Because, hey, it's going to affect her. And if she's not whole with the fact that you're talking to me, so then you're shoving down her throat what you and I discussed. That's not fair. And none of us would like something shoved down our throat. We're all that way. We all can perform better in all of our life if we feel like we were a partner in a decision. So very often I'll tell husbands, go to someone else, someone your wife is happy with, or you're both happy with, obviously. But the key is heveish shfal ruach. If I'm humble, I don't feel like I have a right to shove anything down her throat. I, in the conversation, in the argument, I won. So what? But maybe I just didn't understand her well enough. Why can't she articulate herself? It's a good question. It's a very good question. Maybe over the course of time, we'll have different classes to discuss that weakness. Or maybe it's not even a weakness. Maybe it's just a different conversational style. But the key is, first of all, to be shfal ruach, which we'll continue with in 1 second. Yes? Well, I'm happy you brought that up. There's a lot of misconceptions. I get this question frequently. Like, what's supposed to be the balance of powers in a marriage? And people think that in Judaism, you're supposed to be the man of the house. So I think that, firstly, we have to know that in different societies, there are different norms, meaning different communities have different norms for relationships between a husband and a wife, and that has to be taken into account. Let's take one stereotype, which I just want to share with you guys because you might encounter it in your own marriages. It seems that a lot of Americans can have wonderful marriages with Sephardi women, and that's wonderful. I myself was zochet to be a shadchan, I think, on at least 3 marriages like that, where it was an American guy and a Sephardi, a Moroccan woman, and that's beautiful. And of course, every stereotype is a stereotype, so by its very nature, it's inaccurate. But nonetheless, there are certain norms in certain Sephardi communities. One of the norms, I'll say it over in a joke, you'll understand I'm exaggerating, but I'm not sure how much I'm exaggerating, okay? Because when I say this over to people who are married to Sephardi women, they claim I'm not exaggerating at all. So let's just take the stereotype. So they wake up in the morning, and before the husband gets out of bed, the wife says, give me a minute, she has to wash the floor. She finishes washing the floor, he waits till it dries, he goes out, he takes a shower, he goes out to shul, he comes back home, and she's washing the floor. They're ready to go to work, but they just ate breakfast, so she has to wash the floor, because she can't leave the house a mess. They came home, and there was dust outside, there was ovech today, so at some point now she's going to have to wash the floor, and before they go to sleep again, they have to wash the floor. Remember, she's going to wash it again when they wake up in the morning. Now, If he, God forbid, comes home with groceries he bought, and she just washed the floor, and he walks on that floor, so if you think you heard yelling in your life, believe me, nothing you heard comes close to the shrieks that she's going to start yelling when he carries the groceries across the wet floor. And the terms that she uses are terms that Ashkenazi men like boggle their mind. I don't even know how to translate these terms. You're degrading to me. You're devaluing me. You're causing me to feel inhumane and worthless. And why do you do this to me? And how could you be so cruel and inconsiderate and unkind? And the guy's looking and he's saying, 4 footsteps on the floor, and that's what it does to you? I don't understand. And she's like, you don't understand me, and you don't care to understand me. And I don't know where you grew up, but you didn't grow up in a house, and I don't know what type of person you are, but a human being you never were. And he hears a whole speech, and he's like, over 4 footsteps? And you can understand that the guy's blown away, because the guy's like, you know, I understand you're upset. I walked on your floor. But did I say you're, did I devalue you? The term they use is a tamashpiloti. I don't know the proper translation for that. You're humiliating me. You're, what?
Throw me over your back. You're not throwing me inside.
Not sure the proper translation. So you understand, now here there's a culture difference. If you grew up with that, and you're a man, so, you know, yeah, this is part of, in the Sephardi culture, this is part of being feminine. If you're an Ashkenazi man coming from the U.S., and you get this tirade, like, oh boy, you can burst into tears. You could literally, like, burst out crying over over something as small as that. So now, let's forget cultural differences for a second. I'm not talking about Sephardi or Ashkenazi, because there are big differences in what's considered feminine and what's considered masculine in different societies. But what does Judaism expect of us? So let's first rule out some things that are misconceptions in Judaism. The Talmud says, don't marry your daughter off to someone who's unlearned, because he might smack her. So there's a clear line in Talmud that you're not allowed to hit your wife. But this is discussed in many places. So people quote a Rambam that discusses beating one's wife. Yes, the Rambam also discusses beating a friend. The Rambam is discussing that part of rebuke is to the point where you would hit a person, where you tell a person, don't turn on the light on Shabbos because I might hit you. Right. In a general sense, in rebuke, the Rambam holds that rebuke should hit a point where you threaten a person with theoretically hitting them. That's point number one. Point number two, in the context where the Rambam discussed about one's wife, the Rambam would have said the same thing for a wife on a husband. What the Rambam was saying is that if a spouse, in the times of the Talmud, when you have a court, if a spouse sees that their spouse is going to transgress a law, then they could even bring them to the point of a threat of bringing them to court to be beaten. So let's just take that there's no room in a Jewish home. Lifting a finger on one another doesn't belong there, and no such concept of masculinity. What else does the Talmud tell us about male-female relationships? So it tells us that mechabda yoser migufo, he's supposed to honor her more than himself, meaning if there's a limited budget, she needs a dress for Shabbos equally to your needing a suit, she gets the dress. You have to honor her more than yourself. Okay? What else? The Talmud says a person should get accustomed to speaking gently in his home. A person should show humility in his home. A person should express his humility in his home. The home should be reflective of his humility. So what does it mean to be the man of the house? It's not what people think it means. It's not that what I say goes in the house. No. Quite the contrary. As I'll tell us, Hillel once came home with an important guest, and his wife knew he was coming. And imagine you're coming home with the prime minister, okay? You're Hillel, you're the Nasi, you're a pretty important person. You come home with someone who's pretty important, and there's supposed to be lunch waiting. So they're sitting down and talking, and an hour passes, and 2 hours pass, and finally she comes out with lunch. So he says to her, my beloved, what happened? And the Talmud points out the way he called her, terms of affection. And she, in the Talmud's terms, it's biti. That was their term for affection. So she says, well, I had all the food prepared when you walked through the door. And then a poor man came who was very hungry. And so I gave him the food and I started from scratch. I kneaded the dough, I baked the bread, I started from scratch, and I prepared you the whole meal now. And he blessed her. And the Talmud says, look at Hillel's humility. Look at how his wife felt comfortable keeping him waiting for 2 hours. So think about that. What does that show about being the man in the house? If a person feels that he has to run the show in the house, so the Talmud says it will backfire. Talmud says if a person is tough at home, so then what happens is they know that he wants a bottom line. And then if they didn't light the Shabbos candles before sunset, they'll light them after sunset. They'll end up desecrating Shabbos. If they can't find meat with the hechsher in the market, they'll say, yeah, but he's going to be very upset if I don't have meat at home. So they'll get meat without a hechsher, and they'll end up feeding him food that's not kosher. The Talmud says you apply pressure, you might get the results, but you won't get what you really want. The Talmud says pressure is counterproductive to Judaism in the home. You want to run a Jewish home, it has to be in a pleasant way. And we find other stories of that. We just learned in the Gemara about Yalta, that she was once at the meal and they didn't offer her from the cup of benching, so she got all upset. She went up to the attic and dashed 400 barrels of wine. That's a lot of money, 400 barrels of wine. Now, if she thought her husband would yell at her, so I don't think she would have done that. But you see that she felt very comfortable in the relationship, comfortable enough that when she was upset, she went up there and she bashed 400 barrels of wine. And we have many examples of that in Talmud. Rav Chiya's wife, Rav's wife, he'd ask her for cholent. She'd make him rice. He'd ask her for rice. She'd make him cholent. She'd always give him the exact opposite because she'd try to get on his nerves. The Gemara says, wherever he'd go, he'd buy her a souvenir to show her he loved her. Or wherever she could, she'd give it to him. She'd needle him. So Talmud says, he still loved her. He still said she's his cherished prize. The Gemara says, how could she be his cherished prize? She's making his life miserable. The Gemara says, yeah, it's not a contradiction. You marry a woman when she's young, so she's going to have more fire. She might make your life miserable in a more fiery way, but she also has more dedication, and it's not a contradiction. We sometimes think that if she's doing A, B, and C just to get on my nerves, then she doesn't really love me. And the Talmud doesn't say that. The Talmud says, what? I didn't say we aim for that. When he was learning with his son, so he made a point of telling his son when they learned the verse in Ecclesiastes, I find the woman more bitter than death. He said, like your mother. Obviously, he was telling his son, that's not what you aim for. That's not lechatfila. You don't look for that. But I'm just saying, even that's workable. And even that could be a relationship of love. It's not the ideal love, but it can be. Now, what about yes, dear, yes, dear, yes, dear? Is that the humility we're talking about? So I think there's a balance. On the one hand, a person has to be accustomed to saying yes, dear, more than he's used to. Meaning, I think your grandfather's advice is correct. Not in a demeaning way. Simply, when you take two people who are very different and you put them under one roof, you're going to have situations where your desires, your needs, are in conflict. And as much as a husband thinks that he's giving to a marriage, he's giving maybe a quarter of what his wife is giving in any normal marriage. The normal makeup of a home between the shopping and the cooking and the cleaning and the bringing up of the kids and the doing the laundry and the ironing. At the end of the day, as much as he might be working to make a parnasa and as much as he might be contributing and helping in the house, chances are in any normal marriage, she's at least doing twice as much as him, if not four times as much as him. In most normal homes, she's doing four times as much as him. And it's much harder work. Try running a home for 2 days. The Gemara says that in Mitzrayim they switched. The men did women's work and the women did men's work. So who do you think would collapse? You'd think the women would collapse. What does the Pasuk say? The men collapsed. The Medrash says that the women, they'd give the men koach, they'd come out to the fields and they'd massage them and they'd make them meals and they'd encourage them. How could the woman do that if the women were doing men's work? They were making bricks, they were building buildings. The answer is that at the end of the day, a woman's job at home, a woman's normal job, is much harder on a man. And at the end of the day, they're much stronger than we are. Women are much stronger than we are. If you want to fight a woman, you'll lose. Believe me. Physically, I'm sure you'll win. But emotionally and stamina-wise, women are much stronger. So I think it's only fair, if you figure that she's doing four times as much work, that the ratio of giving in to not giving in should also be 4-1. 3-1, 4-1. And it's also very hard for us to understand their way of thinking. We don't think the way they do. I think a lot of it is also having patience. I'll paint to you a certain conversation which happens often. You have to get to work at 9 o'clock in the morning. Okay? You come home at 7 o'clock. You know, it's an hour ride to work. Let's say, you know, you have to be out of the house at 8 o'clock. Comes 5 minutes to 8, and your wife has a bunch of things to do still before she goes out to work. And your wife says, Amichai, you know, I could really use a hand. I have all this laundry to hang, and I have all the dishes to clean, and the kids still have to get out to Gan, and I haven't yet made lunches for them. And you're looking at your watch. You have 5 minutes to get out of the house. Now, this is a classical conversation. At this point, what happens is you get very uptight because you know you have to be out of the house in 5 minutes. And you're starting to ask yourself, what does she want from my life? Right? That's question number one. Now, if you're the average husband, that's what you say. You look at her and you say, what do you want from my life? I got 5 minutes. Whatever you want, I'll do. But in 5 minutes, I got to be out in the car. And what's her answer going to be? And what about me? I'm chopped liver. I don't have to be out of the house. So you're going to start answering her. And you're going to start saying, no, you don't. You have to take care of the kids, and you have to make lunches, and you have to hang out laundry. And you understand that you're not going to leave the house on very good terms, right? That's a classical conversation. Now, we're going to discuss what does she really mean when she's saying all that. Maybe part of what she means is, I want you to appreciate. Maybe part of what she means is, I want to express how frustrated I am, how hard I'm working. Maybe part of what she means is she wants you to be very impressed and offer a bunch of help and say, well, maybe I can do something in the next 5 minutes. Maybe I can do something at the end of the day. She does not expect you to answer the answer you answer. If you're in the mode of the usual male mode coming out of living as a bachelor your whole life, you're going to respond the classical male way. If you're going to respond, great, tell me what should I do? You're already 10 steps in the right direction. Now, what are you going to do about 8 o'clock when you have to go? So let's say you're going to start doing the laundry, for argument's sake, and then you're going to run to do dishes, and you're halfway through the dishes, and you're going to say, you know, if I leave now, I'm going to be late to work. There are two ways you could say that. One is, you're all uptight. I'm going to be late to work. I can't do this. Goodbye. You'll deal with the dishes, or I'll do it when I come home, but I can't do anymore, right? That's classical male response. But if you're in the mode of, yes, dear, so then you're going to say something different. You're going to say, do you want me to stay home and do it? Do you want me to get there late to work? I could do it. But maybe I should really leave, right? Totally different mode of conversation. You with me? And that's a mode that's going to work in marriage. And the truth is that because we speak different languages, so part of getting us men accustomed to being more gentle and working on having a normal conversation and not blowing a gut when we suddenly get a line that makes absolutely no sense to us. What do you want from my life, right? That's the classical male response. The yes, dear, is getting us into a mode of, okay, I'm not going to respond the classical male way. I'm going to be more patient. I'm going to be more humble. I'm not going to get all upset. And I'm going to try to work something out. And I'm going to work it out from a perspective of, what would you like? And it's a correct perspective. The classical male response is, what do you want from my life? It's very simple. I'm male, you're female. The way men talk is, we don't complain unless we want something concrete from someone else. We don't just express, I got so much to do and we don't want anything concrete. Could be she doesn't want concrete. Could be she does want concrete. But to you, in your male mind, what she just said is she wants something that's an impossibility to you. So now, if you're not used to at least entering the conversation from an amenable point of view, and you'll tell me, why should I be amenable? And I'll tell you, because you don't understand her yet. And you might never understand her, but at least the entrance to the conversation is from a good point. And that's where the yes, dear, is very positive. I always say, if your wife asks you something, your first response should be yes. And then your response should be, but how? Meaning, if she's asking you, you got to go out to the car. That's it. You got to go. Your ride is waiting outside. And she tells you this whole line. So then you could have one of two responses. One is, no, goodbye, I got to go to work. The other is, yes, but how are we going to make ends meet? Because I'm not sure I'm going to hold on to this job if I'm late again. So what do you think we should do? Totally different response. What is it really saying? It's saying, I want it as much as you do. I really want to help. I really would if I could. But what do you say? How do you suggest we do this? Because our desires are at the same place. I've already neutralized the conflict. If I respond the classical male way, the answer is no, I can't. If I'm going to respond the female way, so then what I'm saying is I would like to as well. Can we figure out a way that it will work? It's a totally different response. So I agree with your grandfather that knowing how to say yes, dear, but not in a condescending way, not in a way that is humilifying to you, and not in a way that's condescending to her, humiliating to you.
Take apart like the whole issue about like household chores then, just like in terms of like making like decisions about like you were saying about like where you're gonna live or say what school you want your kids to go to or this or that. I'm reading something somewhere like that, like it talks about like there's two different like mentalities in terms of power. Like there's people that are like there's people that are dominators and people that are submitters. And it says that like that's kind of where like the whole opposite track kind of mentality works out, because like you have two people that are dominators, like it's just gonna be a power struggle all the time. And if you have two people that are submitters, then it's just gonna be a constant like nothing's getting done, like what do you want, what do you want, what do you want?
So I think a person should be a powerful submitter. I think that one way is saying what do you want, and one way is saying what do you think. I'm not going to do necessarily what you want, but what do you think? And very often a wife wants to hear what you have to say, but I think that a husband has to know, every good leader has to know how to get the real information of what the other people are thinking. And I think also we should always strive to get a decision together. And I think it's also very reassuring when couples say and really live by what they say, I'm going to do whatever you want. Let's take a classical scenario. Where are we going to be for Shabbos? Your parents or my parents? So some couples enter this conversation with a very defensive attitude. Well, we're by your parents already, two Shabbosos in a row, and I think it's high time we went to my parents. Now you understand that you've already set the tone for an argument. Whereas if the conversation is, I know you really enjoy your parents, I also really enjoy your parents, and I'll be happy if you want, we should go again to your parents, I'll be happy to do it. Remember, we did go the last two Shabbosos, and I would also enjoy going to my parents. What do you think? Isn't that a much better way to have conversation? I've already conceded my position. If you prefer to go to your parents, we'll go. I'm fine with going to your parents. I would like to go to my parents. I'm not nullifying my position, but I'm putting my position in a very gentle way. And it's not that I'm saying my opinion doesn't count because you're always going to call the shots. I've given my position weight, and I've said that I'm forgoing that weight. I'm saying that I'm fine with whatever you want. I know we were by your parents for 2 weeks in a row, but maybe because you're working so hard, you need that extra break. Maybe a million things, and right now you want to be there. Okay, we'll go there.
And she says her parents again.
Fine. So she's at her parents.
And then the next week, her parents again. There
once was a couple like that, I think that that's the type of question that you have to get to the root of, meaning. I think that the approach should not be to fight the point. Meaning the approach should not be, but I want to be by my parents. The approach should be, can I understand what we can do to make it that you'll also be happy to go to my parents? What is there that it's playing itself out this way? And here we're touching on another very important point. One of the most detrimental things to marriage is when we start labeling our spouses. Meaning, if it happens that for 4 weeks in a row, she said, okay, if you don't mind, I want to go to my parents. Fine, you go. After the fourth week, you have two choices. You could say, I don't understand what's going on here. Or you could say, she's self-centered. She doesn't care about me. And that's one of the most destructive things in a marriage. The second we decide that the other side doesn't love us, so then everything becomes much more painful. Then it's already a hard battle to make things work. And I think that that's a part of Me'od Me'od Avei Shfal Ruach. That's what I was alluding to before with the story of that first couple. That part of the problem of that spouse's lack of humility was not only that they saw the problems in the other spouse, but also that they felt entitled to define the other spouse. That person is self-centered. That person doesn't care about me. That's part of the challenge of not being humble. You could say that person hurt me. Okay, I'm not going to take that away from anyone. But maybe that person didn't mean to. Don't define that person. Don't label that person as self-centered, doesn't care. You don't know what's really going on in the other person. What you know is how you feel. That you're entitled to say. You're not entitled to say what the other person is. So spouses very often say, of course I am, I know them. It's not true, you don't know them. You could be married 20 years and you don't know your spouse. There are a lot of calculations that aren't even articulated verbally, and as well as spouses know one another, there are a lot of things they don't know about one another. And that's where I think conversation has to open on a point of humility, on a point of acceptance, and on a point where I'm not judgmental, which are really all aspects of the same point of humility. So if it happens four times, then I think the conversation, we can go out, and when things are warm and friendly, and not on a point of anger, but quite the contrary, on a point of friendship and warmth, to bring up the point. And I always say that I think that you have to start with, I know you love me, I know you want what's best for me, and I know there must be something at play here which I'm not appreciating, because it's been 4 weeks, and every week you want to go to your parents, and I know you also know that I want to go to my parents, and I'm just trying to understand what's going on. So now in a non-judgmental way, I've brought the issue to the surface, and we're going to talk about it. Now, either we will or we won't talk about it. Either we will or won't get to an understanding now. But at least I haven't judged anyone, and now the floor is open. What very often happens is that she didn't even perceive that you wanted to go to your parents. But we spoke, right, but the way you said it, it sounded like you were equally happy to go to her parents. You even convinced her that you were equally happy. You never wanted her to feel bad about it, fine, but at the end of the day, she didn't realize that it was sacrificed to you. There could be many interpretations. Could be she says, you know, if we go to my parents, I end up resting, and then I'm a much better wife all week. If we go to your parents, I feel like I'm on the display all the time. I can't rest for a minute, and I walk out of Shabbos wife, and I felt it's not fair to you now that I'm having my finals and everything else. I'm trying to do my best to be a good wife, and I felt I wouldn't be able to do that if I was at your parents. There can be many, many different ways that it plays itself out that you didn't even consider. And sometimes, very often, she won't have an answer on the spot. She'll have to think about it herself. And she hadn't thought it through. She hadn't realized that 4 weeks in a row this was her decision. But I think that the yes, dear approach is a correct approach. Only because us men have a tendency to react too harshly the other way. And again, in a positive way. I think if a wife would ask me what's a correct approach to marriage, I would also say yes, dear, but also in a positive way. If we enter every conversation from a perspective, I should really find a way to say yes, so then I'm already 10 steps forward. I'm making peace. I'm finding equilibrium between us.
It's like kavzchut.
I don't think it's only kavzchut. I think it's also it's an attitude. You have to remember, we're entering marriage very self-centered. As much as we might have been a nice guy to all our friends in yeshiva, our friends in yeshiva didn't breathe down our necks. They didn't talk to us nonstop when we tried to get one email or one thought across on an email or one article written or one article read. There are a million things that in a house between a husband and a wife, the fact that she's a woman, the fact that we're different, are going to cause natural explosions. Two men could sit down and work together in a room for 3 hours straight and only share grunts here and there. And not even that. If you're sitting with your wife in the room, forget it. You're not going to have 3 minutes of quiet. And even if you've explained to her that this is very important and you really have to concentrate and you have a deadline and everything, but she just wanted to check if you want a cup of coffee. She just wanted to check if you saw that email she sent you 5 minutes ago. A million little justs, but you're not going to have 3 minutes straight of quiet. It's not natural to her. You know, you're asking her to do something that's very, very, very difficult. Okay, say that. I'm giving a small example of something that very often is a source of friction between couples. So I think that that's part of being humble. I don't really understand my spouse well. As much as we have a good connection, I'm willing to accept that I don't have everything down pat, and I'm willing to hear the other side. That's the humility of Beis Hillel, and that's the humility that gets us into a positive conversation that can really build things. And I don't think it's only dan mekam zchut. It's part of my capacity to understand someone who's very different than I am. We work on different wavelengths. We work on different things make us tick. Different things make us tired. Different things hurt us. And we enter marriage unprepared. most people enter marriage unprepared, and so that approach of being ready to accept what the other side says is a big opening to success, not in a condescending way. I'm with you.
So what if it's just a matter of, what if the reason that she doesn't want to go to your parents' house is something, she doesn't like your parents or whatever it is, and it's a matter of she doesn't ever want to go back to your parents' house? At what point do you just say you gotta go?
Never.
Never?
God forbid.
Can you just go to your parents without her for tonight? Like, can you leave her
alone? No. Okay, you're really pushing me to a corner, but I guess we're gonna forgo our I don't know if we'll get the Navi. Look, this is a very important point. Your first allegiance is to your wife. Your second allegiance is to your wife. And your third allegiance is to your wife.
Does that mean to the point of abandoning your parents?
Even to a point where of abandoning your parents, yes. If a wife says, do you love me more or your mother more? I love you more, 100%. Don't start explaining to her, you know, love to a wife is very different than love to a parent. Love to a parent is different than love to a child. There are three different types of love. And whatever. Don't go. Don't bother. The answer is I love you more. Finish. End of story. Okay? And she's entitled to hear that. The Talmud says, when is it considered that a wife is destroying the relationship? There are times when halachically you don't pay her, even though you divorce her. Technically, you have to pay her alimony. The Talmud says how much you pay when you divorce a wife. There's a whole way of calculating it. Fine. Unless it's her fault that the marriage couldn't last. What's considered her fault? So the Talmud gives us a list of things. One of them is Mikaleles Yoldov Bifanov. In front of him, she curses out his parents. Notice, behind his back is kosher. In front of him is not good. Okay, so it's not kosher. It's not a proper way to behave. It's improper, and it'll tick him off, and he's right to get ticked off. And but the Talmud said that doesn't constitute reason to get divorced. The Talmud also discusses, and the Rambam discusses, that a wife could say, I married you, I don't want to live with your parents. So we try to find the way of making peace, and we try to find a way of making it work, and we find to find common ground. But if your choice is your wife or your parents, so then I think that you got to choose your wife and figure out how to appease your parents. I tell guys all the time, their heretz is you call your parents and you wish them a good Shabbos. But your wife can't stand your parents, so you call them from yeshiva. You go out to a payphone. I don't care when you do the grocery shop on Friday morning, you call them from a payphone. But do star 43, they shouldn't see it's a payphone. Find a way, I don't care. You know, find a way, you owe it to your parents, their hearts, call them, wish them a good Shabbos, but your wife doesn't have to suffer. She can't stand when you're on the phone with your mother. Okay? So find a different way. Call her from work. Call your parents from work. Make sure that they realize you're calling from work, just so that if the line gets disconnected, they don't end up calling back to the house. And then, saying, find a way. You owe it to your parents, you have to do kibbut aveim, but your first allegiance is to your wife. It says, al ken yazov ishet aviv etimo. You leave your parents, the davak bishto, and you cling to your wife. And that's a very important point. I had a guy who was, he came to me with a whole long argument why he owes it to his parents and he doesn't owe it to his wife. So I said, look, I'll tell you something very cruel and very simple. I don't care. I don't care about you, and I don't care about your wife, and I don't care about your parents. I care about your kids. Okay? Very simple man. You're going to make a fight with your wife because you think you're right, you're sacrificing your kids. You're not allowed to sacrifice kids. It's a biblical prohibition, right? There's molech, or it's called idol worship. We don't do that in Judaism. So you want to make a fight with your wife, you want to be a baby, she wants to be a baby, your parents want to be babies, go to a playground and play like babies. You want to be parents, you brought kids to the world, you owe it to them, you owe it to them to have peace in the home. And if you're not going to have peace in the home, you're sacrificing the kids, you're not sacrificing anyone else. You guys, you can handle it, I don't care. So you'll cry, so she'll cry, I don't care about you. I told him straight out, I said, you, I don't care about. Your wife, I don't care about, and your parents, I don't care about, but your kids, I care about. And you owe it to your kids. What did they do? You guys want to be babies so they have to suffer? So your wife says she can't stand your parents. Fine. It's not ideal. I don't like it. I wish we could resolve it. Let's find ways to resolve it. Let's work on resolving it. Let's see how we could resolve it. And you'd be surprised. These situations are resolvable. And we've seen many, many cases where over time, they were resolvable. But I don't think you can force that down a person's throat. And you have to realize that you have two choices here. You force your way with your parents. You lose it with your wife. A wife is entitled to feel, as is a husband, that they are the most important thing in their spouse's life. That's what every spouse wants to feel. That there's no one else that's competing. They're number one, and they're number two, and they're number three, and there's no close runner-ups. They're entitled to feel that. You're going to want to feel that with your wife. She's going to want to feel that with you. Sometimes it means that she says, I don't want to hear from your parents. Fine. So you block your parents' number from the house, and you shut the cell phones when you get home. I tell couples to shut the phones anyways. I say, you come home at night, disconnect all the phones. You're entitled to have time with one another. Your parents want to talk to you, let them call you when you're at work, not at your wife's expense. So, you owe it to your spouses, and you owe it to them that they should be number one. Again, this isn't ideal. This isn't what we aspire for. We do try to work out peace, but we also say, I think it's pretty clear to me, that spouses owe it to one another, that they know that their first allegiance is their spouse, and that it's not going to change. And that there's no competition here. And if a wife, for whatever reason, feels competition with her mother-in-law, or a husband feels competition with his mother-in-law, then the spouse owes it to break off that contact for a little bit. And hopefully over time we'll make peace. Hopefully over time we'll figure out a good balance. But no, I think it's 100% that spouses, to my mind, it's spouses owe to one another, and it has to be crystal clear that that's the way we're building it. Again, it's not ideal, and we don't want to leave it at this state. But if push comes to shove, and it's either this or that, a husband once told his wife, if it's either my mother or you, you better start packing. I don't think that's a right line. I don't think it's correct. I don't think so. I think it's wrong. The pasuk says, "Alken yazovish savivesimo." So chatchila, you have a mitzvah of kibud avim. Technically, as a husband, you have a mitzvah of kibud avim. Find other ways to do it. Even on kibud avim, there's a limit to the price you have to pay. If the price you have to pay is your marriage, then I don't think it's the right price. Honoring your parents. You owe it to your parents, you have to honor them, but there's a limit to the cost. If it's going to cost your marriage, I don't think that's a cost you should pay.
In a sense, we both. It's a mitzvah, but honoring the wife isn't. So how would...
I'm not talking about honoring the wife. I'm talking about your own cost. It says honoring your parents is at their expense, not at your expense. If it's going to cost you your marriage, that's a very big expense. Kibud avim, halachically, they have to pay. They want you to do the shop. They should give you the credit card. You don't have to pay out of pocket. And losing a marriage, believe me, is paying a whole lot out of pocket. No. I think that you have to find ways to make them happy, but I don't think this is a cost that a person should endure. And it's and there are times where you don't have a choice. You're right. There are times when it's either this or that. Okay, I think a person has to be very clear that she is number one. And it goes the other way, too. It's an allegiance that I expect the wife to have, too. And if sometimes there are situations that are more cruel. The parents try to put a rift between kids. The son-in-law wants to learn in yeshiva. The parents are really ticked at that. So every time they call, they just throw a line. They just say, has he started doing something productive with his life yet? You know, I don't want to bother. It's none of my business. I'm just wondering. Has that husband of yours, what's his name? Has he finally gotten a job? You know, they just throw these little lines. And I tell spouses in situations like that, disconnect the connection. I had a story, a young couple. They kept on having fights with one of the parents. And I said, notify the parent that you're not talking to them. I said to that child, when I sat with the couple, I said, you call your parent and you tell them that you're not going to talk to them for the next month and they should please not call. Very cruel line, right? But it saved their marriage. And the parents were, you can imagine the phone calls I got when they gave my reference number. Okay. I said very simply, you have a choice here. You're giving a very clear message. It was one of the spouses, the parent, the mother was an almana, and that child and both children felt they have to honor her. Poor woman, she's an almana. And I said, no, not at the expense of your marriage. And you have to call up and say, we're not going to talk to you for the next month. And if you can come to terms with the way we're living our lives without every time saying a little piece, you say something like that, you should know we're not going to talk for another month. And I told the kids, be prepared. They're going to test you on it. And you have to be prepared to walk out of the conversation, walk out of a family simcha, out of a family of fear. But that's the allegiance you have to give your spouse. That if they're going to throw such a line, because what happens is when they throw these lines, they do weaken the marriage. They do affect us. At the end of the day, it might not affect you the first time you hear it, but after a period, parents can destroy a marriage. And I don't think kids owe it to their parents. What they do owe their parents is to have a beautiful marriage, which the parents will have nachas from. So if it means you have to go through a period of pain, I could only say that that couple has been sending me other couples all the time. So it worked. You know, after a half a year, after a year, the parents got the hint. And now there's shalom, there's peace. And they go to their parent for Shabbos. And they have good relationship with that almana. And they do everything. They're nice people, this young couple. But she didn't get the hint that she cannot keep sticking in her venom. So she was just being innocent, just asking a question, you know. But that just asking a question, we realized when we were talking. To me, it was very clear that the other spouse was like really seething. The spouse who was the son, the daughter of the almana, they didn't see it. They didn't see how ticked the other spouse was. But I saw that the marriage is sitting here on the brink, and it's sink or swim here. So, yeah, I told him, call the almana and tell her, over, we're not talking for a month. And you think during that month, so uncles and aunts started calling, you should have seen, it was like Aliyah Lergolim. Suddenly people start coming to their house, knocking on the doors, you can't do that, you have no money, you can't do it, da-da-da. Okay, long speeches, every night I'd get another phone call, and every night I'd have to explain to them, luckily you don't have much of a choice here. It's your marriage or her. Explain it to her, be nice to her, explain to her. I want to give her one more chance, give her one more chance, but I'm promising you, she's not going to live up to it, and when she doesn't live up to it, you got to do it. After once, after twice, she'll get the hint.
Sorry,
I'm not telling the story the way it was, by the way. It's I'm changing some of the facts, but okay.
No, that's very realistic.
I'm only changing facts, so you can't. You'd never be able to put together the two and two. But if the couple is watching this, they know they're there. I'm saying no one else could put two and two together. But yeah.
So in a situation like that, then I know it's an extreme situation. See that situation, but like, is it better off in a case like that where you should just cut the parent off right away, or is it like, should you try to like tell them like, listen, you can't be doing that, should you try to reason with them and make them understand, or should you just be like, listen, you've done it, I told you before, goodbye?
I think that we always try to do things in pleasant ways, and I think that a person should try. My recommendation is that if saying it didn't work the first few times, to write a letter, because in the letter you could think it out and you could cite examples, and there's less emotions and you could be more respectful. And I think that part of it is also they have to respect the way you view it, even if they disagree with you. Meaning they're going to say, I didn't mean it in a bad way, I meant it in a good way. And they're going to say a whole bunch of things that you're oversensitive and you're misinterpreting what they said, and they're all offended by the fact that you said that. And the point has to be that this is the way I feel it's affecting me, and this is the way I feel it's affecting my marriage. And in light of that, so I'm asking you respectfully to please not do A, B, or C, and give very specific examples. Now, sometimes it's better to just be practical. You know, sometimes you don't have to say it. You can just not answer phone calls. The phone contact could be severed. And the message very often is felt after two or three times. Sometimes it's better, you know, not to take things head on, to be more diplomatic about it. That if you feel like this is what's happening, say take a month where you don't call your father or your mother or whoever it is. And after a month, they're like, hey, you know, I haven't heard from you in a month. And yeah, I'm sorry, your life's been busy. You know, you don't have to take it head on. You could try once or twice to do it in another way. And then they'll see if they get the hint. And there are different ways of doing it. I don't think there's a one size fits all. And I think that we always try to find more pleasant ways of doing things. Meaning, you took me to a last resort type of situation. Obviously, we try everything before we hit such a situation, and we try everything as a couple. But everything does not mean that we also try hearing all these comments and making believe that they don't affect us. More often than not, they do. And the impact sometimes takes years, but we've seen it really, really hurt marriages. We'll just conclude with one line. There's a famous saying that says there are three major causes of difficulties in marriages. One is money. It could be arguments about where to spend money or monetary issues. Number two is intimacy. The whole issue of the bedroom and intimacy can be a very big source of tension for couples, that things are not working out the way they'd like in that area of their life. And number three is in-laws. And some say that in-laws can take 60% of the pie and the other two are relegated to the remaining 40%. At 60%, some would say 60% of marital issues can be traced back to negative impact from family. So we do have to be aware that it is a serious issue. But here we sidetracked. But it was an important point, so we sidetracked tonight. Okay. Yeah.
What about this weird saying, family first?
I don't know.
As opposed to marriage first, let's say.
We didn't say that here tonight, did we?
No, you didn't.
Right? Okay. So
it's
no.
It's not supposed to be a good thing that you do that or something.
We try not to sever ties with our family. We're not looking to isolate ourselves or someone else. What?
I mean, raising kids, more towards that.
So I think that we owe it to our kids. We didn't discuss a situation where it's the daughter or the wife. We discussed a situation where it's the mother or the wife.
Okay.
Children is a totally different story there. We have to figure out a different solution. What? So that we're out of time, and Bezrat Hashem, we try to deal with things so it doesn't hit such a thing. That's, you know, then in that each case, you know, that's unusual. That's unusual. So in-laws is usual. Children is unusual.
Well, the children do reach an age where they often play the parents off each other.
So parents have to be smart to that. They have to outsmart the kids on that. Yeah? No, I was witness to a couple that really had serious issues, and they said that there was one of the kids that was working very hard to make a rift between them. So it was very sad that they were intelligent enough to realize it, but not intelligent enough to solve it. That's sad, isn't it? It can happen, but that's unusual. That's right. Dumb.